Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, I'm so glad that we have a chance to come together. And we've got a very interesting publication we're going to be talking about this evening. The title of it is The Moralists. The Moralists. Now, what kind of an image does that bring into your mind? Well, I know when I first became aware of it, there were all kinds of things that went through my head. Believe it or not, I even thought about the Salem witch trials. I thought about European history and the history of people that, to the best of our awareness, no matter what their culture might be, there were always those people that thought they knew what was better for someone else than anyone else did. And it is quite a provocative read. The book The Moralist by Glenn Duns Wheeler is, I think, quite a conversation that many of us may find ourselves at one time or another having with people. What is the right action to take? What do we need to do? How do we look at what the consequences might be for our judgments, our decisions? Are we willing to face those consequences? And there's so much more. Glenn Duns Wheeler, I want to thank you for being my guest this evening. This is quite a, I'll use the word, a provocative read. When you were writing this, and you have been a filmmaker, you have been in various societal environments, and every society has its challenges, and you're an entrepreneur. What in the world made you decide you want to write a book about a group of people that call themselves the moralist?
So I've been trying to solve homelessness in the U.S. since 2010. And this book kind of came out of that, because we find ourselves, especially in the United States, in moral conundrums. We found so many times that because of the rule of law and because of liability and fear of liability, the best option is to do nothing. And I saw that over and over again in working with trying to solve homelessness in the U.S. So then I started thinking, well, what if we had to do something? What if doing nothing wasn't on the table? What if neglect wasn't on the table? What would that look like? And I started bouncing that idea around in my head. And I grew up with this idea that, well, why can't we just have people that give more to society than they take? And if they take, well, then we get rid of those. And when I was a kid, and people would get mad at me when I'd say that. And then I said that to my mother again when I was thinking about this, the moralists. And she got so angry with me. And she said, well, what about nurses? Nurses find their existence in helping others who can't take care of themselves. And I thought, ooh, that's a good conundrum. What about that? And so I just started thinking through all of the things that don't get done in the world because it either affects some other people or it's against someone's rights. And then I kept following through with that.
One of the things that you do with your book is you're very, very upfront that this is something that is fictional content. And just as you have described the dilemmas of people doing nothing and the conundrum, and that's a good word to use, evolves and everybody stands around and there's nothing that is resolved. This is something right. that has been an incredible challenge for humanity, period. Although yes. there are very decisive people that will say XYZ is not acceptable, And like you said, there are laws and there are all kinds of things that go on. But you say difficult societal conundrums. And if you enjoy soft stories, soft characters, happy endings, romance, and other light subject matter, this book is not for you. If you're negatively impacted by anything harsh that humanity does, this book is not for you. And this is something, when I started reading your material, I thought, that's quite an entry. I can imagine a lot of people would be putting the book back wherever they saw it and go, geez, who needs that? On the other hand, there are those people that really feel very much like you do. How do we resolve situations? How do we resolve the fears that come about? I think of the school shootings. Schools have become, in many instances, like prisons. And you've got security guards. You have all kinds of things that are going on. Society ends up being imprisoned by its very fears. And this is something that you bring out. And so you have all of these different characters. And you say you, and I know that you've done this because I've gone through your book, but you didn't just focus on the United States. You also brought in Bangor and Manila and the Philippines and the island. All of these different areas, including many places in the U.S., you bring in, because this is a group that comes together and they have their own code, if you will, which is not unusual. This is what groups have done for millennia. And the thing is that they have a very different perspective. They don't want to do harm, but they want to hold people responsible. And that is a big issue in your book. People being made accountable for their behavior and their actions, isn't it?
Yes, and there's even a sect inside the group. So the moralists are a movement, and they try to stay on the positive side of things. But then there is a sect within the movement that says, we actually have to do something about, we have to make the difficult decisions. And so even in within the moralists, there's trouble in between the two groups, saying, you know, you're doing things, the sect is doing things that is potentially hurting the cause of what the moralists are doing. So I don't know if we should separate ourselves or we should not have you exist, you know. And then this group that does things has start to inspire copycat crimes, which also cause great trouble for the moralists, because people start asking, did the moralists do this? And are the moralists a cult? And are the moralists a religion? And what is going on here? And we have this problem in the U.S. with many groups. When something happens, you know, let's say it's Islamic, and then there's a terrorist act, and people say, well, is that Islamic or is that just terrorist? And so people are always trying to figure out how people are equated, and the moralists have that component in the book. We really go through all the problems for when people start making decisions. What I tell people is, in order to get to the socialist utopia, you have to be fascist at some point. Mm-hmm. And no one likes that.
Well, do you blame them? My God,
no.
Anybody that's been under dictatorship or fascism or, you know, communism, whatever it is you have, if you really know the facts, you don't want anything to do with it. So,
right.
But you're
especially
correct.
If you're the person that is being gotten rid of, you don't want to be that person.
Well, not only that, it is a reality that this is why we have so many challenges. I look at what is going on today. We have an environment that's been around for thousands of years that has existed throughout different cultures in the world. And by golly, it is absolutely awful. And to be able to stand up and say that is not acceptable, well, you would have been put to death for that. It's just the way it is. So America Right. has always stood for the rights and privilege of the individual and also of people collectively, as long as no harm is done. I mean, we have been able, as a nation, in many respects, to be able to stand up and say this is not what we want. But my goodness, it's something that evolves. It is a fascinating Yeah. fact of human history. You can have those that are like the moralists, and then the next thing you know, you can have the fascists. And we've got stuff like that going on right now. So there's this balancing act. And this is what you bring out. And there's a part of the group called the Clean Sweep.
Clean Sweep, yeah.
Clean Sweep. And there's the trackers, the panelists, the feelers, the runners.
Right.
And you're dealing with human beings, human egos, human that may or may not have a way of thinking clearly.
Yeah, right.
Looking at various things. It really is quite a provocative read. And you wrote this in a way, because you've been involved in films, like a script. I mean, there's just
right.
so much conversation here. When you were doing this, because of the conflicts, the points of information that come out with each and every aspect that you bring forth, it must have been, you must have felt like you were in another world when you were writing this.
I call it storytelling Jenga, because what I really try to do is build the characters and then make those characters act logically for them. And if I change something on page 30, maybe that affected something on page 120 that I then had to go compensate for. So it all, because it deals with 30 some odd people and, you know, 14 cities and, you know, maybe about 6 or 7 main stories that affect one another, it was really just this, as we see in the real world, something happens and then that affects another thing down the road, or that affects another person down the road. So it was really a challenge to make it logically fit together in a cohesive story. But I really wanted to delve into those conundrums to we'll say, what happens if this happens, or we do this, this character does this, what would the reaction be?
Mm-hmm.
And it took me quite a long time to build that story.
Well, I can understand. It's like the fellow that was in prison, one of the characters that you have, and he is anything but a nice person. And he's just someone that is, I don't even think he's mentally ill. He is just a person that creates misery wherever he goes, and whoever he is involved with and associated with ends up in prison. And it is, he's eliminated, to be perfectly frank. My goodness, we watch Westerns. There are movies that have talked about quiet people or individuals. I think Clint Eastwood was one that did so many Italian Westerns and different movies. And it was always, gee, I'm going to make sure that this person isn't going to get away with this anymore. It's time to clean up the act. And I think of The Equalizer. I think of the Texas Rangers and the Chuck Norris sequels, and he passed away just recently. But all of this has a tremendous impact, because so many people feel like justice is never served. And it really is quite a deal. Now, you have something in the story, the Kill 'Em All software detail. And you say how this software is constantly being updated. It's imperfect. But there is so much information, people of all ages putting information out on the social media, even today. I mean, it's as if there's no sense of privacy anymore. And this is something, you give the positives and the negatives, the givers, the takers, and so many different facts of software example entries. And when I was reading through that, I thought, good Lord, we actually have that in place today.
We do. We do. And China has their social credit program, which I in the book, I say it was inspired. The Kill 'Em All software was inspired by that social credit program where you track people and, you know, they get points for raising children successfully. And they don't get points for not raising those children successfully. And, you know, they get points for doing good deeds, but they don't, if they do harm to somebody, they don't get points, or they get points taken away. And that was kind of the model. And it's the beginning point for that sect, the clean sweep. They run people that they identify that might be taking more from society than they're giving, and they put them through that software, and then that software gives them the direction of, should we pursue this person and trying to fix them and make them a productive member of society.
Mm-hmm. And there's just so much that is very provocative, as far as I'm concerned, in the book.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And
yeah.
You did that deliberately. You want people to think, don't you?
Yeah, it's pushing buttons. It's definitely that's why that warning is up front. I was thinking through all of the content warnings, and authors have a lot of discussion about if they should put content warnings in front of their book. And I just thought, I really want people to know what they're getting into, because my goal is to push buttons to make people think about things that they usually don't want to think about. A good friend of mine refuses to talk about politics. And for me, politics is a great jumping off point to talk about humanity and human interaction, but she just won't do it. You know, and there are people that my mother just wanted to know who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. And she wanted a happy ending. And if it wasn't a story that had clear good guys and clear bad guys and happy endings, she wanted nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, well, I like dealing in the gray area and the problems and trying to work through this stuff, but I'm going to warn people. I'm not going to surprise them. And that's where that content warning at the beginning comes, and really the front matter of the book that lays everything out. So people know what they're getting into, because I really don't enjoy surprising or torturing people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really feel that as people get into the book, there's a number of issues that you bring out. And one of them concerns a 10-year-old boy, Oz, and I may be mispronouncing his name, so please correct me, and his mother.
Yeah. And what young people can find on the internet and their joy of independence, but then how the real world is scary to young people, and he's one of these characters where he gets into finding the moralists, and he gets excited and he wants to do research on who the moralists are. And then there's all this stuff happening, bad stuff happening that the news is covering. You know, there's this prison gas attack that everyone is talking about, and he wants to get involved. And his mother, I guess you could call her a helicopter mother, you know, upper middle class, protective, wants him to be engaged, but is really worried about his health. And sure enough, he's scanning the world, and he ends up witnessing something that gets live streamed on the internet that really disturbs him. And, mm-hmm. you know, a 10-year-old cannot handle the real world and the brutal, all of the brutalness that the world has to offer, you know, that we, so there is this argument that we should protect our children, but then how much do we protect our children, and how much do we expose them to, and who can expose them to those? And with Oz, we're also having this question of permissions, you know, how much of the world can he see? Because the internet has allowed people in very secluded areas to see huge swaths of humanity. And sometimes we just are not prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, when you live in a bubble, that's very true.
And let's
face it, if you're working and you have a family, or even if you're a single person, you're working, supporting yourself, you may have your own family, your parents, or maybe even that special person in your life. But you have your routine. You get up at a certain time, you go to work, and you do whatever it is that you've got to do. And you may feel like you're on a hamster's wheel. And so when you get on the internet, then that is sort of a relief. But in many instances, it's not a reality. It is
right.
It is less than, sometimes yeah. significantly. And that's what happens with this little boy.
Yeah, and it's also a concern that from his mother that he is interacting with people that are out to do him harm, which is a real factor on the internet. You know, mm-hmm. you have different adults that are looking to get to children, and they use the internet to do that. And so there's a moment where the mother steps in and says, I don't know who you're talking to, and I need to find out because mm-hmm. this is not good. Right. And I remember being young and not wanting my mother to step in. And, you know, this is pre-internet, but still, that's what a parent has to do sometimes. And my personal life experience, I really just am constantly impressed. Just don't mess up the children, because then they perpetuate the things that you mess them up with as they grow up. So don't mess up the kids. Don't mess up the kids. And I tried to put through Oz and a few other examples and through other characters, I really tried to put that forward and just try not to mess the kids up mm-hmm. because they'll get, when they get older and they get messed up because of the stuff that happened when they were a kid. And we don't want that. We don't want them to be messed up. We want them to be upstanding people. And there's, you know, the one of the opening scenes is, Rachel goes into this hospital room where this baby has just been born, and the software has identified this Phil as being kind of a screw up father. And she says, you're a parent now, don't mess this kid up. Right. And that's, so there is, the moralists are really concerned with not creating damage. You know, you can only fix so much damage that has already happened, but let's not create more. And that's also kind of my personal dictate. And obviously I've thrown a lot of me into the book and tried to wrangle with what my thoughts are on all this stuff. But yeah, it's definitely, I definitely am a proponent of not messing up the kids.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, because you have a subject matter, the island, which is a very significant place. Yeah. And there's the do-gooders. There's yeah. so many different aspects of human character that you share in the book, The Moralists. When you were writing this, and how long did it take you to put this together? Because it's very, very complex. And I know you've been involved with films and with scripts and that type of thing. And that's how, when one is reading it, there is that interaction. It might be fun for a book group for someone to say, yeah. I'll be Jack, and then there's the operator, and there's Will, and
right.
there's all these conversations. It might be fun to have something like that, say, who would like to read this part? And
yeah.
that would bring it to life in a very significant way, and then have a discussion with each chapter.
Yeah.
This...
Yeah, absolutely. The island came about because we in the book we deal with Sad Camp, which is on an island, but there's also Mad Camp and Bad Camp. So Sad Camp is for depressed people, Mad Camp is for mentally ill people, and Bad Camp is for criminals. And the in my imagination, I had the moralists have benefactors, rich benefactors that were able to donate property for these different camps. And they then pay for these very expensive programs, because especially in the U.S., we're always putting a dollar sign on people's lives. How much is this worth? How much is this going to cost? And to rehabilitate people is very expensive. And the island is a place where Sad Camp happens, and all of the sad people that are in states of depression get kidnapped and taken to the island and can get involuntarily put in a program that they can then get out of if they want, but then their life is also being tracked. And in the book, we give them about a year to get their life together. And if they don't get their life together, well, then Randall comes for you, right? And Randall is the one person, there are people identified that kill people. And there's no other way to say it. And Randall is a person that is tasked with ending people's lives. And we also see what that does to him. Because at the end of the book, he's tired of ending people. He's tired of killing people. He has no other value in life but ending others, which really tasks people that have to do that.
Mm-hmm. You bring out so many factors, and I think of films in the past like Logan's Run, and there's so many sci-fi situations. You know, think of George Orwell and his writing, and
right.
We have H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, and you have all of these different people, and there's so much more that has been out there talking in their particular way about much of what you bring out in your book. So you've got a different perspective. And this is something, when we look at human history, people buy in to this kind of the good guy deal. And they'll say, well, everything's fine as long as it doesn't touch me. And then guess what? They find they don't have any rights whatsoever. So it is fascinating as a read, but it is also something that makes you say, I wouldn't want to see that happen. I wouldn't want this to occur. And there is a woman who does not, she is a nurse, and she questions things. She's questioning it all the time.
All the time.
All the time. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, this whole idea of, well, do you support death? Well, no. Well, okay, do you support abortion? Right? That's a hard question to mm-hmm. answer. And mm-hmm. especially from a nurse, and we cover that, and it's very difficult. The one thing that I wanted to do, kind of different from George Orwell or other kind of dystopian books, is I wanted to put this in today's land, in present land. This has happening now, and this is happening in your neighborhood. This isn't some other land. This isn't some other time. This is right now. This could happen right now. And I really wanted to do that, to push people so they couldn't say, well, this couldn't happen here. Because especially when I was working on homelessness, people would say, well, it can't happen in Salt Lake City. It doesn't. We don't have any homeless people here. You know, so I really, in all my work, I want to say, no, this could happen. And what? Look, this is how. I'm showing you this is how, and this is how maybe we decide it doesn't happen. And there have to be decisions that have to be made.
Mm-hmm. And it's really a situation, and various cultures have various attitudes about much of what you discuss in this book. And we can look at what's going on in today's world. Look at the stuff that's going on in the Middle East as we are having this program. There is this concern about a war, and there's a war in the Ukraine and the Russians, and we have places in the Sudan and other areas of Africa. And you go, when is there a possibility that we can have some semblance, if you will, of not being at war? But we human beings seem to want to engage in it at one time or another. And I go, why? You destroy everything. What are you going to do? If you take out the grid, if you destroy homes and agriculture, you're going to die of exposure, and you're going to die of starvation. And if you don't have transportation to get goods from one point to another, if you don't have a good infrastructure, everybody's going to end up just basically not surviving. This is a conundrum with the human species.
Yeah,
it's a big one.
It's a social agreement, right? What is the social agreement? And in this country, especially, our social agreement is get what you can for yourself. And that is all we have. You have to have an agreement. You get this, but we get this in return. And oftentimes we live an adversarial life. And what we get for adversarial lives is war and conflict.
Mm-hmm. AJ is one of the characters I really liked in the book. And I liked his demeanor. He would be like what I would call the peacemaker. And that's because as a man, he had lived long enough and had seen enough that he knew how to deal with personalities that were enraged for whatever reason. And most of the time, the rage is not logical. It is not logical, and it shouldn't even be happening. But that is immaturity. Right. That is immaturity.
And AJ specifically stops road rage, which road rage happens a lot, right? That we live with that because we drive so much. But yeah, AJ is one of what I call the feelers. It's the people, the empathic people, the people that try to look through and past the emotion using their emotion to really understand what that motivation of that person is and to work through it.
And there's an interesting story about a character, Matt, and his scene of being in jail. So I won't go into any more of that. But it is, I know that this, when I finished reading it, I said, this is a conundrum that exists with humanity. But boy, it would make for a good conversation and actually for debates to, take one chapter or one segment of the book and say, all right, we'll play the different characters and then let's talk about it. What do you feel about this? And you'll get all kinds of feelings. And then to find out why. It is intriguing. And I think that's one of the biggest things we need to do is have that open communication. So your book, The Moralist, is provocative without question. And it brings to the forefront a lot of what many people want to ignore, but it is true. It is true. Yeah. Now, Glenn, you're in California, and you have a website, and it's your name, Glenn Dunzwiller, and that is D like David, UNZWEILER.com. And people can go and contact you through your website, can't they?
Yes, they can.
What kind of a response have you had to the people that have read your book?
My friend said I had to invent people that I had the same viewpoints with in order to have friends. He said, you invented people to hang out with. And I said, well, the moralists are kind of pretty dangerous sometimes, so I don't know if I'd hang out with them. Other people have said, because people do accuse me of creating my own cult, they said, you've made your own cult. And it's always, because it is provocative and it doesn't settle well with people. They find something in the book that they find unsettling. And it's doing its job. Mm-hmm. It's doing its job.
Mm-hmm. Stimulating thought, asking questions. Yeah. Are we going to be sheep or are we going to stand and stand tall and say, this is not acceptable and we need to look at how we can handle things differently? It really does make a difference. It really is. Yeah. Like I said, you've just reinforced it. It is a very provocative publication. And Glenn Dunzwiller, I want to thank you very much for being my guest this evening.
Thank you for having me.
You're more than welcome. It's a doozy of a book.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care now and keep up your writing.
All right. Will do.
We're saying goodbye to Glenn Dunzwiller. And, one of the things that I feel that happens many times in our world today is that people do not want to engage in open discussion. And one of the things about knowing history or being aware of history or having family members that have come from maybe different countries, different situations, that they've got different kinds of experiences that they share. And most of them, I know, especially those that survived the Second World War, they often would not share anything with anyone. They just keep it all bottled up inside. But I really, really think that when we can have an open conversation and we can have a debate and we take an opposing position, actually, to maybe what we believe, it really is amazing what we become aware of about ourselves. And I remember when I was in high school, there was a class on public speaking, little realizing that that was going to become a significant part of my professional life and even my personal life. But I went into a debate, and it was on the death penalty. And I was in California. I was born and raised in Southern California, and that was an interesting challenge. And then we had a coach for a teacher, and he brought up some very provocative subjects, and by golly, I was put into the positioning of being told that I was going to address the subject matter of how the death penalty should not be used. So my fellow student was told he was the one that was to enforce the aspect of the death penalty. And I can remember getting up out of the seat at my desk in the classroom. And I think I was about 15 years old at the time. And walking up to the front, because he would dish out subjects, and we had 30 seconds from the time we left the desk to go up front and then to speak, to address whatever he assigned us. So we didn't have a choice. And by golly, there was a big thing going on in California at the time regarding the death penalty. And I'll never forget what it was like going from my seat in that classroom, walking up to the lectern that was in the room, and then being able to put together my positioning on why it should not be done. At 15, I really didn't know much of anything, but I managed to do it. And I actually, they had a vote after the debate was done. Then, and I won, and I was surprised. But it was a fascinating experience, because I found myself, when the other student was talking about how important it was to have the death penalty and why and so on and so forth, and he is really well read on it, and I thought, wow, those are interesting thoughts. And I've been fascinated with people's perspectives ever since. Why is that? Because there's more than one way to observe a condition, a situation. But then there comes that point where you have to decide on the action that's going to be taken. And that is something that life taught me at a very, very early age. And it's a fascinating thing. So having debates and listening to the different perspectives, boy, it can really, really be fascinating. And I'm not talking all about all this bashing junk that often goes on in politics. No, I'm talking about open, clear conversation. And sometimes when we're put in a positioning of being that devil's advocate, if you will, it can really present some outstanding levels of information. Now, I do want to give you Glenn's website again. Again, this book is a humdinger. Glenn Dunsweiler, or Wheeler, you can pronounce it that way. And that's GlennDunsweiler. And it's just amazing how someone's imagination, due to circumstances in life, creates questions for them that they didn't even know that they were ready to ask. Do they have the answers? Not necessarily, but it is fun to be able to write about what if? And that's one of the things that writers have been doing forever. Now, Donna Sebo here, and I want to let you know the phone line is open, and I appreciate the thoughtfulness of many people that have said, gee, you're sounding like yourself again. Yes, I want to make a comment. I want to say, please, take care of yourselves. There is some kind of a virus. It's airborne. I do not know what it is. I didn't have any testing. But having been through the flu experience or the virus experience through, you know, different times of my life, they're never fun. It's always the difficult time. So take care of yourself. And if you are in public places that are heavily congested with people, if you're going to concerts or anything like that, use common sense. Just be prepared. And above all, make sure you get your rest. Because when you're exhausted, you are vulnerable. And if you have a challenge with your immune system, you want to be sure that you are not going to put yourself into a situation where your immune system is going to be compromised. Also, have a healthy respect for others. And if you feel like you're coming down with something, excuse yourself and manage to get together another time. It really does make a difference. Now, if you're listening to this program for the first time, I want to welcome you. And the Donna Sebo Show is heard 5 days a week, Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 p.m. And I feature authors from around the world. The newsletter went out on the 1st. Yes, it did. It went out. And by golly, I've had a lot of comments about it because there is information about a woodpecker that is in the editorial. And so that has been interestingly received. But also, we have Warriors for Peace. And we've got some very good programs. And we are going to be talking about that as we go along. And then the Donna Sebo television show, the first filming of the year, episode 20, is now posted up on YouTube, my channel, the Donna Sebo Show channel, and also it's up on my website in the video section, so you can see it there. And know that any of the radio shows, the latest 13 to 15 hours, are in rotation in the player section on the network page and also in the archives as well. All of it's free 24/7. Now, if you as an author would like to have the opportunity to be on either radio and or a television program, send me a copy of your publication and be sure to put your contact information inside. My goodness, I get these books that people send me and they don't have contact information there. If nothing else, put in a website. If you're going to have a book printed, put in the website where people can find out about you and your information and have a contact page in that website. I've even encountered authors that didn't have a contact page. And I go, why in the world do you even have a website? We've got to have a way of reaching you. Where do we go? Well, most people will go to Amazon. But just realize, if you want to be considered for my program, you will send your book along with your contact information to the Donna Sebo Show. And Sebo is spelled S like Sam, 2 E's like Edward, B like Boy, O Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Again, the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. And allow some time for me to have a chance to review your material. And then you can contact me also through my website, DelphiInternational.com. There's a contact page there. All you have to do is Google my name. You'll find all kinds of links there. And we have an event coming up towards the end of the month. And that's the BEPC event. This is done twice a year in the spring and in the fall. And I've been a participant in that, doing many sessions and speaking for many years. So I thoroughly enjoy it. It's a wonderful event, and it's held at Kent Commons. Now, you can go to my newsletter, and all of the details, the address, etc., is there for your viewing pleasure. And if you want more details about some of the special programs that are done, then go to the BEPC website, as it is given in my newsletter, and you're going to find that there will be all kinds of details available for you. Well, Easter is coming up, and, oh, if you wanted to give me a buzz, 253-582-5597. And I had a meeting with some friends, and I found some adorable little bunnies. They weren't very big. And we had a little mini bunny race that was, we were all just in stitches, just absolutely laughing like crazy. But the Easter bunny and decorated eggs, my goodness, it goes back thousands of years, that tradition. And there's so much information about the Easter eggs. And dependent on the culture that you find yourself associated with, those Easter eggs can be extremely complexly colored. And the Ukrainian eggs, when my husband and I were in the former Soviet Union and we had the opportunity to go to the Ukraine, the beauty of their Easter eggs was just absolutely amazing. And I have some, and they're just a delight to look at. And of course, that is just something that's really big, the Easter egg hunt, all of this. But the egg is a representation of the world egg. Now, you may or may not be familiar with that, but that goes way, way back in time, because the egg was a symbol of spring, of fertility, and the ancient Persians gave each other eggs at the equinox, just as we do today. And it just is a representation of life coming forth. And we in America, there were the egg rolling contests, the egg hunts. My neighbors, they have children, and they have a particular home, a family home, where the entire family gets together at Easter. And they go around, and of course the adults are hiding all of the eggs, and some of them are plastic because they put candy and other things in them. But it is really a tradition that when I think about when I was growing up, that was just part of school, and we would color eggs. We'd go and buy the egg coloring kits at the store, and it was just a lot of fun. And of course it was a time that everybody went to church on Easter Sunday, even the men in the family. That's the one time that men, when I was growing up, would even go to church. Most men that my family were aware of did not want to put a foot into church. And I came from a Catholic Lutheran background. And I know my dad, that was the only time that he would go to church, is on Easter Sunday. And that's because we usually would go out for breakfast. So that was all part of the pattern. But the traditions that we carry, even today, they're age old, they're fascinating, and it's just so amazing. You know, I think of the Fabergé eggs, how magnificently they were designed. And, you know, beauty is beauty. And it's just a lot of fun, I think, for the Easter week that we are living in right now. Of course, dependent on where you are in the country, depends on whether this is Easter week for you for spring break. But here in the state of Washington, it definitely is Easter week. Went to a particular facility to donate some items, and found a sign on the door, "We'll be back on the 7th. It's spring break." And I just looked, you know, at my friend who had taken me over, and we just said, "Spring break? You're closed? Not open?" "Yes, they are closed." So there's all kinds of traditions that people have, and it is really fascinating to see. Oh, by the way, I did want to share a recipe with you, and it is about a dish that the Greeks are known for, and it's moussaka. Now, I remember the first time I ever had moussaka, I determined I never wanted to eat it again. Whoever had prepared it, and this was in a fancy restaurant, it was one of the most flavorless dishes that I had ever eaten. I'm of an Italian background, and I didn't have a cold, so it wasn't because my taste buds weren't working, but I developed an attitude about it. However, I have a recipe, and this is, again, traditional Greek. It's made with eggplant, ground lamb, tomato sauce, cheeses, and herbs. Now, you can substitute beef, you can substitute chicken, or you can make it totally vegetarian. It's going to be flavorful anyway. And I just thought I wanted to share that with you. Now, if you're not familiar with eggplant, it is something that years ago I learned that eggplants are like sponges. You have to salt them first and just let them release a lot of the water that is in there, dependent on the recipe that you use. But let me give you the information about the meat sauce and the cream sauce that goes along with the eggplant and lamb. And I don't know about you, but typically when you go into a supermarket, if you want lamb, you have to order it because a lot of Americans don't eat lamb. So they'll have beef or they'll have chicken or they'll have sausages or something else. You can use whatever you want in this recipe, but the Greek way is lamb. And also you can use goat meat. Any kind of meat will work for this kind of a recipe. Now, you're going to need a 3.5-quart Dutch oven, and you're also going to need to have a 2-quart baking dish, 12 by 7.5 by 2 inches, because that is the dish that you're going to use once the procedure for the meat sauce is taken care of. You're going to need that. You're going to need that to do the layering of the eggplant. So this is what we've got in ingredients. You're going to need 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 cup of finely chopped onion, 1.5 pounds of lamb, ground lamb, or your favorite meat, 1 clove of garlic, and that needs to be crushed, 1/2 teaspoon of dried oregano leaves, 1 teaspoon of dried basil leaves, 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1 teaspoon of salt, dash of pepper, 2 cans, 8-ounce size of tomato sauce. You're going to need 2 eggplants. Their weight should be 1 pound, 4 ounce with each, and you're going to wash them and dry them off. Then you're going to need 1/2 cup of butter, just for the eggplants. And then you've got the cream sauce. Yes, this has a very, very flavorful cream sauce. You're going to need a little bit of butter for that. 2 tablespoons of flour, 2 tablespoons of butter. I better be clear with that. And then 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1 dash of pepper, 2 cups of milk, and 2 eggs. Then in addition, your cheeses, you need 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese, 1/2 cup of grated cheddar cheese, and 2 tablespoons of dry breadcrumbs. Now, there is a cheese I would recommend, and it may not be that easy to find, and that is the Gruyere cheddar. Yes. Oh, it's fabulous. The flavor is out of this world. Okay, so this is what you do. In butter, we're going to start with your meat sauce. You need the 3.5-quart Dutch oven. You're going to put onion, your meat, your garlic, and you're going to put it in that Dutch oven, and you're going to saute it until it becomes brown, about 10 minutes. Then you're going to add your herbs, spices, tomato sauce, bring it to boiling, stir it, reduce the heat, let it simmer uncovered for 1/2 hour. And then, while you're doing that, letting the sauce thicken, then you're going to slice crosswise 1/2 inch thick placing in the bottom of a broiler pan, you're going to take your eggplant. You will have cut it lengthwise in half. And as I just said, you're going to slice it crosswise a half inch thick. And you're going to sprinkle it lightly with salt and then brush it lightly with melted butter. You're going to broil the eggplant. And it needs to be 4 inches from the heat, 4 minutes per side, or until the eggplant is golden. Then you're going to make your cream sauce, and that is easy enough. You're going to melt the butter and then take it off the heat. You're going to whisk in flour, salt, and pepper, and gradually you're going to add your milk. You bring it to a boil slowly, stirring until the mixture is thickened. Remove it from the heat, and then in a small bowl, those two eggs, you're going to beat them, you know, just like you would for scrambled eggs, and then you're going to add a little bit of the hot sauce. You're going to temper those eggs, and then you're going to add that tempered egg mixture that has been whisked together. You're going to return that to the saucepan, mix all of that together, the eggs, and you're going to find that it blends very well. Put it to the side. Your oven should be preheated to 350 degrees. And in a 2-quart baking dish, the size being 12 by 7.5 by 2 inches, you're going to take half of the eggplant and you're going to put 2 side-by-side layers. And you are then going to sprinkle with 2 tablespoons of the cheeses that I have mentioned. And that is going to be fine. And then you're actually going to add some of the breadcrumbs into the sauce. And I look at that and I go, okay, your tablespoons of dry breadcrumbs that were mixed with the cheeses, that's great. And then you are going to spoon evenly, you know, all of that evenly over the eggplant. Sprinkle it with, again, you're going to make another layer, overlapping everything. And then as you have completed those 2 layers, that cream sauce, that silky cream sauce, you're going to pour it over everything in that dish. And you're going to bake it for 35 to 40 minutes. It will be golden brown. And you can brown it if you want the top of the dish to be that finished look. Then you can put it under the broiler. Watch it very carefully because it won't take long for it to really get that beautiful golden brown coloring on the top. And then let it rest. And believe me, it'll stay hot for a good deal of time. And it serves, I would say, 12 people. If some people have a hearty appetite, I'd say 6. It would, you know, dependent on how hungry they are. But if you have this with a salad and fresh bread and some vino, delicious, delicious meal. So that's moussaka, Greek style. Now, I will tell you, I do not care for the flavor of cinnamon in this dish. That's my bias. If you don't like a flavor, then take it out. Don't be afraid to experiment with food. Recipes aren't, what do I want to say, in that holier-than-thou territory. That's why people just come up with all kinds of different ideas. Remember, you are in charge of what you're doing. But I would suggest that you, if you enjoy vegetables, and again, if you did not want to have the meats, you could totally eliminate it and just have this as a vegetarian dish. So it's up to you, but eggplant is something that is dearly loved by the people of the Mediterranean, and it's a beautiful plant. So anyhow, there you go. That would make a lovely Easter dish and would be much enjoyed, and actually, the flavors build as you allow it to set. Remember always, you're the master of your fate, you're captain of your soul, and I'll be back with you tomorrow, same time, same place. Oh yes, more good things to share. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.